From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Decoding the Holocaust. January the 27th, 2025 is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau, an event marked annually by Holocaust Memorial Day. In order to perpetrate the mass killings and other crimes of the Holocaust, the Nazi regime needed to coordinate and communicate about its activities. This included wireless communications, which were intercepted and decoded at Bletchley Park. In this episode, we look at what the Government Code and Cipher School knew about these Nazi crimes, how and when this information was obtained, and how Western governments responded to the news. Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, is joined by journalist, author, and Holocaust historian, Christian Jennings, to discuss his work on the role of code breaking in these terrible events.
Christian, welcome to Bletchley Park. Thank you for coming. To get us started, can you tell us a little bit about your personal background and what led you to study this subject in the first place?
Yes, thank you, David. Excellent to be here at Bletchley Park, where the magic happened. And yes, my background, I was a foreign correspondent for 14 or 15 years, based in 23 countries across the Western Balkans and in Africa, writing primarily for Reuters News Agency, for The Economist, sometimes for The Daily Telegraph, The Scotsman, about wars, ethnic conflict, humanitarian disasters, and in some places, the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide in Burundi, Kosovo, Bosnia, about the process of and the aftermath of genocide itself, which led me to have some understanding of how they're planned, how they happen, what it looks like on the ground, what it looked like in the churches of Rwanda, the forgotten eucalyptus groves of Burundi, the freezing fog of Kosovo in the winter morning, the mortuaries, the mass graves of eastern Bosnia with the exhumed remains of the 8,000 plus Bosnian men and boys who went missing at Srebrenica after they were murdered in July 1995. After this, I worked for an organization in the Balkans called the International Commission on Missing Persons, which uses a combination of human rights and DNA identification techniques to match the remains of missing persons killed during wars, conflicts, natural disasters, exhumed from mass graves in the case of war victims, and matched with blood samples taken from their living relatives, meaning that the relatives can give these thousands and thousands and thousands of missing persons a burial. And this combination of science and human rights, where science acts as a counterweight to evil, is something that led into my work and writing about the Second World War and code breaking and decryption. After Bosnia, I went to live in Turin in Italy and have written a number of books based in Italy, not just about the history of World War II in Italy and in Europe itself, but also a book about the Holocaust in Italy, a book about the history and a story of German code breaking in the Second World War, the first comprehensive volume written in English. And then the book published this year, The Holocaust Codes, which focuses on two characters, a British cryptanalyst and intelligence coordinator at Bletchley Park, and an Austrian SS officer who's the operations manager for five of the worst camps in German-occupied Poland, Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, Chełmno, and Majdanek, Austrian SS Major Hermann Hofli. And this book itself, the research on it, led to much greater, wider research across the archives of, in fact, 20 countries done in up to 10 languages, looking at the epicenter of the Holocaust, as one might call it, not for a moment suggesting that what happened in with the executions on the Eastern Front in 1941 and 42, the first phase of the Holocaust, nor the Operation Reinhardt camps The third huge phase was Auschwitz. And my current book, which I'm writing and working and researching on now, called Decoding Auschwitz, which was about how the Allies and neutral countries fought back against the Holocaust, and how the Allies, particularly the British and the Americans, decrypted what was going on at Auschwitz and what we knew when and how and what we did about it.
I get the sense that you come at these, what is ultimately a very grim topic, from the same way that I approach military history, that getting these people's stories correct and getting behind the mythology and describing things as they were is kind of an act of memorialization in its own right, and it's important to tell it and to get it right. Would that be fair?
It's very important to tell it and to get it right, and to keep on interviewing, to keep on investigating, to keep on reading archive material until you do get it right.
You've mentioned the word a couple of times there. For the benefit of our audience, and so that we can be specific about what we're talking about, we use the word Holocaust. What is your working definition of that in terms of the books you're writing and the research you've done? I know that if you go on the internet, there are a variety of versions of it.
The Holocaust was the systematic state-sponsored persecution and mass murder by the Nazi regime of over 6 million Jews, Poles, Catholic clergy, Roma, Sinti, homosexuals, Russian POWs, communists, partisans. Those who the Nazis had deemed to be worthy of extermination. This is what the Holocaust was. The word in Hebrew is the Shoah, which means catastrophe. And the Germans themselves used the phrase, the final solution, which comes from the Wannsee Conference, Reinhard Heydrich and Eichmann's talking about the final solution to the Jewish question. And the Holocaust itself has become the accepted term for this program of state-sponsored mass murder, extermination by the Nazis during the Second World War.
I've seen that some people choose to use it to talk only about Jews, but your research is covering the more broad definition, you would say, of, I mean, some aspects of the story are specifically concerned with the Jews, but you have looked at the picture more broadly, I take it.
Yes, I've looked at the picture more broadly. And the more you look at the story of the Holocaust, the more you look at the story of the extermination of Europe's Jews in the Second World War, the more you realise quite how many other people in a subordinate way were also being killed from other, not smaller groups, but less well-known collective groups. It was predominantly the Jews. But for instance, if you were to look at, for example, Polish Catholic clergy killed in the opening phases of the German invasion of Poland in 1939, and this will bring us on later to one of the questions about the Vatican and what it did or didn't do during the Holocaust. Rome and the Holy See in Italy knew exactly what the Germans were capable of because so many Polish Catholic priests had been executed from the beginning of the war onwards. And the Roma communities across Europe knew what was going to happen because one of the first groups in Germany to be deported alongside Jews were 5,000 Roma. Russian POWs, Russian soldiers, Soviet prisoners of war, captured communist officials. These were all deemed execution fodder, people to be killed. But by far the largest group, massively outnumbering every single other one, was the Jews of Europe themselves.
And it's also separable into, we'll get into this later when we talk about Operation Reinhardt, but it's both explicit extermination and death by work as well, isn't it? There's the exploitation of labour.
There's slave labour, the use of Jews until they have no more physical energy to give to the Reich, as it was described one way. The head of the concentration camp system at one point worked out how much each Jew was possibly worth, all the kilocalories and joules of energy that could be taken from one human body, knocked off against the amount of food required to keep this person alive and working, and then the cost and value of their ashes at the end and use thereof. It was the use of slave labour, and it was also the extermination of those who were not capable of providing slave labour, or those who were too old, too ill, infirm, children, women, anybody who didn't fit into their category of being somehow useful who couldn't contribute their labour towards the Reich were to be exterminated. And this comes up again and again and again during investigations and researching the final solution, which is the SS operations to use tens and tens of thousands of Jews, Poles, and other prisoners, Russian prisoners of war, as slave labour, while at the same time, slightly different subsectors of the SS are trying to take them to extermination camps. And they're being used for work purposes. Work is a horrible euphemism. It was being worked to death through slave labour, carrying huge chunks of granite in the quarries around Mauthausen on almost no food per day, simply until many of these people would be dropped dead from exhaustion or were just shot on the spot. So it's a combination, yes, of slave labour and extermination. And a perfect example would be at the Auschwitz III, the Monowitz camp. It was a subcamp of Auschwitz where there was a factory run by the German industrial conglomerate IG Farben, where slave labour from Auschwitz was used. And when these Jews were simply incapable of working, they were returned to the extermination camp next door and gassed. And these Jews were used within the whole variety of industrial processes that took place at Auschwitz III, one of which was making the component parts of nerve gases. And Jews were used within this process, within this manufacturing program. And then when they became of no further value, they were just exterminated in the Auschwitz-Birkenau part of the camp. And what you had there was the Third Reich's desire to work them to death, to make them contribute as much as physically possible before they could be exterminated.
To take us back to the beginning of the story and to Bletchley Park's role in this, we're talking about the understanding the Western Allies had of what was going on. When is the first information received by the Western Allies about extermination activities in the East? And to what extent is SIGINT part of that story?
I think from available information and research, I think we can say that the first mass execution of Jews on the Eastern Front in 1941, in which Signals Intelligence played a major contributing part to finding out about it, if not the, took place in the town of Slonim in Western Belarus at the hands of Einsatz Commando 8, where 1,153 Jews from the town were taken out in lorries to an area outside the town and executed by German Einsatz Commando, made up of German policemen, SS personnel, some local auxiliaries as well. And Slonim was a town in Western Belarus that had been overtaken by the Germans as they advanced in June. And by July, the Jews had been, as was happening across dozens and dozens of towns, villages and cities across Ukraine, across Belarus and across the Baltic states as the Germans advanced, the Jews from the town were segregated, robbed, everything made to pay a ransom of all the gold they had, taken off outside the town and just executed. And the day after this took place, on the 18th of July, the SS general in charge of the behind-the-lines activity and Army Group Center sent back a message saying that yesterday 1,153 Jewish plunderers had been shot. This went to Himmler. It was intercepted by a listening station, a Y station at RAF Chicksands Priory, and delivered to Bletchley Park, along with dozens of others at this stage, detailing mass executions on the Eastern Front. These were encrypted largely by the Einsatz Commandos in a coding system based upon code books called double transposition, sent by Morse code once encrypted and then decrypted by Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park called this collection of German police codes, number one, number two, number three, and the different keys that were used within these codes to encrypt the messages. Bletchley Park called this collection Domino. And the SS and German police killing squads on the Eastern Front were sending messages of dozens of these killings back to the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, in Berlin, who'd asked for a clear, regular and total accounting of the execution of the Jews on the Eastern Front. Yes, Russian prisoners of war, Russian communist officials were being killed as well, but the absolute vast majority of these were Jews. And the numbers were extraordinary. In the 23rd to the 30th of August, just in one sector of Army Group Center, 7,920 Jews were executed in just over a dozen mass killings. The police commander of Army Group Center estimated in the last week of July alone to the middle of August, his men had executed 30,000 people. The 29th to the 30th of September, outside Kiev, at the ravine of Babi Yar, 33,771 Jews were executed as well. These were probably, Bletchley Park estimated, that they were decrypting messages accounting for probably only half of the Jews who were being killed. And given that they were decrypting far more messages from one area of operations, i.e. in the center of the Eastern Front, rather than the north and the south, they were picking up information only about a partial total of these killings.
And so GCNCS and the British government is alerted to what's going on from fairly early in the process. If we consider Barbarossa starts in June 1941 and we're talking July and August, aren't we? You were just saying with the dates there?
Yes, the shooting at Slonim in Western Belarus. The first major signal intercepted and decrypted by Bletchley Park was 18th of July. The incident took place on the 17th of July, and these are all taking place, yes, as you say, you know, a month after the beginning of Operation Barbarossa. These messages are being passed to Stuart Menzies, the head of SIS, who's overseeing and running Bletchley Park, and to Churchill as well. After a bit, the volume of messages about executions on Jews of the Eastern Front becomes so substantial that Bletchley start putting them in regular special summaries to the Prime Minister instead of message by message by message. And the aim of the special summaries is so that it's easier to get the Prime Minister's attention drawn to what is gradually becoming apparent is happening as the German Wehrmacht and armed forces advance across Russia.
So we get a lot of information fairly early on. Does this persist for the rest of the war, or does it come in sort of stages?
This was the first phase of the killings of the Holocaust, which was the mass executions on the Eastern Front, carried out by SS men, German policemen, local auxiliaries, men with rifles standing in firing squads, shooting at men, women and children at pretty close range to kill them. This was the phase of the three phases of the Holocaust that generated the largest number of messages that were decrypted by Bletchley Park, simply because the Germans were sending a message about each individual killing. Every unit, every platoon, every company, every battalion was reporting every day until they started putting their reports into courier-delivered messages, started sending them by other methods apart from decryptable signals.
So are they feeling that there is a risk in transmitting this stuff already at that point?
Yes.
They're getting nervous about putting it on the airwaves.
Exactly. They get increasingly nervous about putting it on the airwaves because they suspect the enemy might be decrypting their messages, which of course they are. And then on August the 14th, 1941, Winston Churchill meets President Roosevelt on the British battleship HMS Prince of Wales off Placentia Bay, off Newfoundland. And they're there to discuss the shape of a post-conflict world. Churchill then returns and makes a BBC broadcast on the 24th of August, where he refers to executions carried out by German police troops. And these two key words in this extraordinarily long broadcast condemning what the Germans are doing on the Eastern Front in Russia is picked up by the Germans themselves. And in decrypts of German messages, the nervousness that their signals are being decrypted becomes apparent. The head of the German order police, General Dalloege, sends a message around on 13th of September, which Bletchley decrypt, which is read, saying there's significant fear that the enemy may be listening to their messages, decrypting their coded signals. So After this message on the 13th of September 1941, the Germans changed their codes. But in one of those ironic fortunes of war that was to change so many things about the Allies' knowledge of the Holocaust in the Second World War, they changed it from the coding system called a double transposition to a system called a double playfair, which, as Nigel de Grey, later intelligence coordinator at Bletchley Park, was to write, was easier to crack than the double transposition system. And the German police coded messages, the German police codes, Domino, as it was called, didn't change from this point onwards for the rest of the war. And the messages that were being sent from the extermination camps run under the so-called Operation Reinhardt from Lublin in the general government area of occupied Poland were predominantly, the messages that were sent in a whole mixture of Enigma encoded using one-time pads, encoded using signals code books. There were less messages. The diktats of complete secrecy and complete silence around Operation Reinhardt, which it was the secret within the secret of the Holocaust, meant that there was much less communication about the numbers of Jews being exterminated in Belzec, Treblinka, Sobibor, Chelmno, Majdanek.
As you say, it's a secret within a secret. This is the, as opposed to Auschwitz, which is a work camp, at least in part, and is a very large complex, these Reinhardt camps are very small, purpose-built sites just for executions, aren't they? For
yes, correct. Extermination.
They are a kind of a subset of the wider Holocaust, but they are really the heart of it in terms of just the pure rounding people up and killing them.
Yes. The Auschwitz-Birkenau complex, you know, comprised the three main camps and dozens of sub-camps. But as you say, one of its camps was extermination, another was forced labour, another was factories. It was divided into three, essentially. The camps around Lublin, the Operation Reinhardt camps, were purely extermination camps. The four, Sobibor, Belzec, Chelmno, and Treblinka, particularly Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor, were just extermination camps. It was the use of carbon monoxide gas from vehicle engines, and then moved on to Zyklon B use of gas to kill the Jews. Majdanek was outside Lublin in a suburb of the city of Lublin, was used also as a death camp, but also a slave labor camp as well. But Operation Reinhardt was first and foremost an extermination operation.
They are even more conscious of security and even more chary about communicating, but they do still communicate information about this program, don't they, to a certain extent?
They do communicate information about it. SS Major Hermann Hoffley, who is a character who appears in my book, makes his subordinates sign very draconian secrecy agreements. They can't say anything, they can't report anything, they can't mention it, they can't take photographs, they can't write anything. No information can be passed to anybody, even within the SS infrastructure itself. It's a very draconian secret being kept, even from the SS, about what is going on. And consequently, they're signalling back to Berlin about the numbers of Jews who are being killed is much, much, much diminished. And it's only in January 1943 that Hermann Hoffley sends back a numerical accounting of all of the Jews who've been killed in four of the camps in the Operation Reinhardt system. And he sends the message both to Krakow and he sends it to Adolf Eichmann in Berlin, describing the 1,274,166 Jews killed in four camps in 1942.
It's a kind of terrifyingly specific number, isn't it? There's something very chilling about the exactitude of this material.
Exactly. They've all been counted. They've all been documented. Every single one of them has been numbered. Indeed, back in the Jewish Affairs Office in Berlin, the Austrian SS lieutenant who's planning and arranging the railway deportation operation of the Jews, SS Lieutenant Franz Novak, is receiving lists of Jews back from Auschwitz, for instance. And in some of the earlier phases of deportations of Jews to Auschwitz to be killed, as opposed to be worked to death, they get descriptions back giving their cause of death. And he and his secretary and the other ones in the Jewish Affairs Office see these lists of Jews coming back that give again and again and again their individual cause of death as heart problems and stomach disorders. And this excuse, this awful euphemism for extermination, continues. And it comes out in Adolf Eichmann's trial, until suddenly no more lists come back from the camps, because the people there are just going into a great big black empty nothingness of extermination, and no cause of death is ever reported back.
We've talked a lot about Eastern Europe in this story, and it's clear that a lot of signals intelligence material is coming from there. It struck me when reading the book, what about deportations from Western Europe? And I know you've worked on Italy as well. And perhaps this is where non-SIGINT sources come in as well, isn't it?
Information was available about deportation from Western Europe as well. And it was both from decrypts of SS and other German messages and Italian messages as well. It was also to do with Bletchley Park's decryption of up to 20 or more countries' diplomatic codes from across Europe, in fact, across the world. A good example would be Bletchley Park and, by extension, the Allies learnt about the ongoing deportation of Jews in Bulgaria by reading and decrypting messages from some of the countries whose Jews were present in Bulgaria. And this gives you an idea of Bletchley Park's wide-scale successes in decrypting a vast multitude of ciphers. They found out about the plight of Persian Jews in Bulgaria because they had decrypted the diplomatic ciphers of Iran. They found out about the plight of Spanish Jews in Greece because they had decrypted the diplomatic codes of Argentina. They found out about the plight of Italian Jews in Greece because they decrypted the diplomatic codes, not just of Italy, but of Spain, of Portugal, of France, of Japan, of Romania, of Argentina, of Brazil. The list was endless. And the signals that describe the fears of the Spanish Foreign Ministry, the Italian Foreign Ministry, the French Foreign Ministry about their Jews in other European countries gives a very good picture in 1942 and 1943 about the deportation program of the Jews from Western European countries, Italy particularly. The SS Einsatzkommando, led by Eichmann, that went into Rome in summer 1943 to deport as many as possible of the Italian Jews as they could following the Italian surrender and the German occupation of Italy. Adolf Eichmann and the Gestapo in Rome are communicating furiously with Berlin backwards and forwards about the deportation of Italian Jews, or rather their failure to arrest enough of them and deport enough of them. This came up in the book and investigation I did about the Holocaust in Italy. The SS operation to arrest the Jews of Rome in the first incident in October 1943, there were some 10,000 Jews in Rome. And the SS succeeded in arresting and deporting, I think the figure was 1,016 of them. They missed 80% or more. They made sure first, of course, you know, being the SS and up for extortion and robbery almost as much as deportation of human beings. They robbed the Jews blind. In fact, again, this comes up in messages decrypted from Bletchley. Is the program being used by the SS in Italy for personal enrichment, whereby Jews would be ransomed? You know, part of a family would be put on a train to Auschwitz. The rest of the family would be told that this person could be taken off a deportation convoy for the payment of 1 kilogram, 2 kilograms, 4 kilograms of gold, or equally valuable resources that could be sold on the black market in Switzerland by criminal Italian middlemen. This was a very large part of what the SS were doing in Italy, and just one reason why their deportation program of Italy's Jews did not succeed nearly as well as they wanted it to.
This sort of corruption, if you like, though, this is officially sanctioned, though, isn't it? Because the Nazis are very opposed to personal enrichment by people involved in the Holocaust. It's the SS gaining gold for the SS rather than individual officers making their fortune.
It's individual officers trying to make their fortunes. It's across the board, trying to steal something for themselves illegally, because this contravenes Himmler's diktats about the money found and discovered and stolen by the SS belongs to the SS. It's the duty of every SS man to return it to the SS. The SS are making a phenomenal amount of money from all of the gold, currency, jewellery, precious metals, watches taken from Jews taken to concentration camps. This is going back to the Reich. This is going back to Berlin. And that is the SS self-appointed legitimate extortion program. What isn't legitimate in the eyes of the SS is any man who's trying to make any money for himself and his colleagues, his henchmen within the SS, which is what is going on in Italy with the connivance of Ernst Kaltenbrunner's office in Berlin. So what this brings us back to is the volume of messages sent by the SS about the deportation program of the Jews from Italy was in codes that Bletchley had decrypted, SS and Abwehr signals, in complex codes, ISOS and ISOCycle, which they had managed to decrypt and could read. There were also incidents, for instance, like they knew about the deportations of Jews from Greece because they were reading messages sent from the SS in one point back to Eichmann's office in Germany, where the SS are complaining that the International Red Cross in Greece are trying to obstruct their deportation of the Jews. The Red Cross are trying to take Jews from Salonika and Athens and put them into convoys to sail to Palestine, and the SS are trying to deport them to Auschwitz. The messages describing these brave actions taken by the Red Cross, again, are sent to Berlin. They're decrypted by Bletchley. Messages from other countries in Western Europe also come up. So from a network of decryption, the Allies become aware of the deportation program from Western European countries as well.
Christian, you've well explained just how much information was flowing not only into Bletchley Park, but into the Western governments across the board about what was going on in the Holocaust in Europe. But that begs the obvious question, what options were available to the Western Allies to actually do anything about it? And in turn, what steps did they take to respond to what they were learning?
The horrible irony was that in many ways, the Allies knew most about the Holocaust when they were least capable of doing something about it. On an individual message by message, killing by killing, incident by incident basis, they could be said to know more about the actual executions, the killings of the Final Solution in the period in 1941 and 1942 on the Eastern Front. And this was a period when the Allies were struggling desperately to keep an even hand in the Battle of the Atlantic. They just started fighting successfully in North Africa. They hadn't even had a footprint in Europe outside of Special Operations Executive and resistance missions inside occupied Europe. And this is the point at which they cannot do anything to stop these killings, and yet they know so much about them. And so what they do in the first incidents is they know what's happening and they know instantly. They've learned very fast, very hard from the example where Churchill gives a speech, the Germans change their codes, that if they don't keep their knowledge of what could be called now the Final Solution, if they don't keep it contained along with the other vital war-winning intelligence being taken from Ultra, they're going to lose the signals of Enigma and Ultra. They'll probably lose the Battle of the Atlantic. They'll lose access to the entire German intelligence transmission system. They will be absolutely blind to what the Third Reich is doing. And they know that there isn't anything they can do concretely with this information at this point. So they're knowing, but they can't stop it. The Russians are retreating. Operation Typhoon, the German attack on Moscow in winter 1941, is about to take place. And the Allies are realizing that mass killings, executions leading to an extermination of the Jews is taking place. So what they do is they gather the information. They realize this information will be obviously utilizable at an incredibly high level in eventual war crimes trials against the Germans. They must do something with the information, but they can't lose Ultra and Enigma. they're caught in an absolutely terrifying dilemma. They can't tell the world what is going on and blow the source of the intelligence. So what they actually do is they try and tell the world without blowing the source of the intelligence. And bear in mind, at this point, the world knows that the Holocaust, as we'll call it, is taking place. For one example, when the Germans killed the 33,000 Jews outside Babi Yar in Kiev in Ukraine in end of September 1941, the media were present. Journalists from newspaper and wire telegraphic agencies sent reports about this. The Polish underground, absolutely huge, vital, brave organ bringing information out of Poland under conditions of extreme danger to the Western Allies, was taking place. The Polish White Books and Black Books, which were documented lists of atrocities published in Britain and the United States based upon information received by the Polish government in exile in London, are coming out. The Holocaust is a very large, very, very horrible, very big open secret. And the Allies know that if they stand up and make a broadcast that says to the Jews of the world, the Jews of countries occupied by Germans, this is what the Nazis have in store for you, extermination, they will lose every single intelligence asset they have and their knowledge of their enemies' plans, tactical operations, strategic operations, and current operations across the world. So what they do is they strategically suppress the information about the source of their knowledge, and yet they work together with other nations under one of the first United Nations declarations in December 1942, where they come out and tell the world. Anthony Eden, the Foreign Secretary, stands up in the Houses of Parliament and reads the Declaration Against the Holocaust, the cold-blooded policies of extermination. They're telling the world the Holocaust is taking place, but amongst all of the more well-publicized sources of this intelligence, they don't betray their hand from Bletchley Park. If they had, they would have lost their ability to decrypt German messages about the operations of the Wehrmacht, the Luftwaffe, the German naval enigma in the Battle of the Atlantic. If the Allies lost the Battle of the Atlantic, convoys couldn't cross. American soldiers for a future liberation of Europe couldn't cross the Atlantic. The war was being decided at that point in the middle of the storm-tossed waters of the Atlantic between U-boat wolf packs, Allied escorts, and Allied convoys. And while a lot of it was based upon the deployment of aircraft, the deployment of radar, sonar, bombing of submarine bases in France or Germany, massive amounts of it was based upon Bletchley Park's decryption of the German naval enigma. It's in and out of the German communication systems with its submarine wolf packs. If the Allies had lost the Battle of the Atlantic then, Britain would have starved. America wouldn't have been able to help. Stalin may well have made a separate peace with the Germans because the British wouldn't have been able, with the Americans, to launch a second front. Ultra and enigma cannot be compromised. And if this means that their knowledge about the mass executions of Europe's Jews must also be held in check, then this is what they're going to do. But they're going to broadcast their knowledge of the final solution. They are going to strategically suppress their knowledge of the source of the information. The two are very different and very important things. And what this then leads on to is the second phase of the Holocaust, one might call it, the Operation Reinhardt camps. This is a phase where, and I've seen this in genocides, by the time the perpetrators are halfway through, the outside world, the powers that be, in or out of a war, are normally only starting to be aware that it's happening. By the time they're making a decision to do something about it, it's two-thirds of the way through. By the time they're doing something about it, it's normally over. Operation Reinhardt is over by November 1943, even before the Western Allies have largely found out anything about it. But there's another unknown trump card, which comes up in my forthcoming book, which is that up until the end of 1942, Bletchley Park and Allied intelligence have given every single thing they know about the Holocaust to Moscow. The Red Army is on the back foot, and the Germans are advancing into the Caucasus towards Stalingrad. End of 1942, the battles around Stalingrad are increasing. And the Red Army are the ones who are physically closest to the concentration and extermination camps in Poland, particularly, and the ones who'll be able to do something about it. And Bletchley Park generate intelligence, which the Allies then passed to Moscow in a intelligence sharing scheme. The Russians see what is happening. This gives them an extra incentive to start offensive operations, which will lead them towards the eventual liberation of concentration camps. Obviously, the main one of these was Auschwitz on the 26th of January, 1945, which is the background of Holocaust Memorial Day. But Majdanek in Poland, one of the Operation Reinhardt camps, liberated in July 1944, the first camp liberated by the Russians. And also this leads on with assistance from the Allies to an enormous behind-the-lines operation being carried out in Poland by Polish, Russian, Red Army, Jewish partisans against the entire railway infrastructure and SS and Wehrmacht military infrastructure behind the lines in Poland, which includes pitched battles with German SS and police units. There's one, Operation Hornung, that's from January to May 1943, seeing thousands of partisans fighting against the SS and German police, particularly around the city of Lublin. And in these messages, which the Germans are sending in the German police code, which Bletchley are decrypting to realise what's happening in Poland, the Germans take the prisoners they've captured to Chelmno camp outside Lublin, one of the Operation Reinhardt camps. Survivors are liquidated. The second thing is the enormous Allied intelligence and covert warfare operation, which is being carried out as well, led through the Special Operations Executive and the American Office for Strategic Services. And this gathers pace as the Americans form the War Refugee Board. Eventually, Roosevelt decides, under pressure from predominantly his Treasury Secretary and colleagues, Henry Morgenthau, decides to act, and they form the War Refugee Board, which is a combination of massive financial help to Europe's Jews, creation and maintenance of escape networks, secret agents parachuted in, neutral countries helping. This comes to a head in the operations around the German deportation of Hungary's Jews in 1944. And the other less well-known, but much more predominant than popularly thought, operations were those ones carried out by the Vatican and by the Red Cross especially. Bletchley Park was reading the decrypted signals of the Vatican, for instance. And across Vatican and Red Cross decrypted messages, and messages sent by the SS describing the Vatican and describing the Red Cross, a picture emerges of a much more muscular response to saving, helping, and publicising the plight of Europe's Jews than popularly imagined. And so the Allies then find themselves in the position where eventually, in summer 43, in July, they land, they're ashore in Sicily, Allied boots on European soil. And the first Jews that they are effectively able to help are the Italian Jews. The Allies advance up Italy, and Jews who've been in hiding since the Germans invaded and occupied Italy start taking refuge behind the Allied front lines. The Allied action in Italy was so important because one thing that genocide effectively needs is it needs a stable logistical operating environment to be able to happen. Trains need to run. People need to be arrested, deported, contained. It needs to be done in a country that is occupied and semi at peace. And this wasn't really possible in Italy, where the Allies were advancing slowly up Italy. The Allies were increasing their radius of their bombing campaigns. Thousands of Italian partisans fighting behind the lines, helping the Jews who often join partisan groups. The German attempts to carry out the Final Solution in Italy were considerably less successful than they wanted because of this. They were operating in the middle of a war. And the options available to the Allies, the much vaunted, why didn't they bomb railway lines leading to concentration camps, has several answers. I mean, the one of the things the British were trying to do, particularly at Bletchley Park, was to decipher the enciphered messages of the German Deutsche Reichsbahn, the German railway system, which was taking the Jews to concentration camps. And they did this with limited success. It was a very complex enigma-based system. But a lot of it was to do with the fact that the sheer numbers. Franz Novak, Adolf Eichmann's railway deportation officer, personally organized the departure and the arrival of pretty much every single train convoy containing the Jews of Western Europe and some of those from Central Europe. In the entire war, Novak arranges 707 railway convoys. In an average month, in April 1942, there were 35,600 railway departures from main stations across the whole of the Third Reich, north to south, in 1 month. So the Holocaust deportation convoys are a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the massive amount of military transport trains, hospital trains, civilian passenger trains moving across Central Europe. Finding the right ones, knocking out the locomotive, not the carriages, destroying the railway line in question was something that required extreme levels of capability and skill with precision bombing and making sure that you actually hit the right train. It was very hard to do. In fact, it was only attempted 3 times with any success in the Second World War, once by Belgian partisans with a train of Belgian Jews going to Auschwitz, once with limited success by Italian partisans, and the third one took place in occupied Poland by partisans with more success, where they sprung prisoners from a railway convoy. The way in which the Allies' decision-making process about whether or not to bomb camps, to bomb railway lines, it was slowed down by process, by committee, by decision, by the American Air Force saying they might want to do it in theory, but they didn't want to do it in operational practice. It was slowed by initial protests from Jewish groups themselves in Israel and the United States, who thought this was the wrong thing to do. This is what happens in genocides, is the resort to committee and multiple decision making by soldiers, by diplomats, by politicians, particularly across many countries where communications might not be as good as they could be, slows things down. And genocide has a terrible entropy of its own. It speeds up as it goes on, as more people are killed. And by the time the Allies had decided not to bomb concentration camps in 1944, the Holocaust was almost over. But the actions that they did take, for instance, the actions of not just the American War Refugee Board, the Hungarian authorities' refusal to continue the deportation of Hungary's Jews because of the American bombing of Budapest, OSS operations, SOE operations inside Hungary itself, the Red Cross, the Vatican, all of these came together between March and July 1944 to significantly impede the Holocaust of the Hungarian Jews, where 432,000 of them were deported to Auschwitz, but another 300,000 plus were almost certainly saved because of this.
So you're painting a picture of, it's a mixture, there's individual efforts sort of at a local level to disrupt the system, and there are political decisions being made to try and interfere. But at the same time, there's this a certain amount of bureaucratic inertia, sensitivity about signal security, all sorts of other factors. So it's a very complicated picture. But the $6 million question here, really, which I think the book addresses very well, is there have been scholars who've come out over the years and explicitly accused Churchill or Roosevelt or other Western leaders, Western governments more generally, of stepping away, of having a policy of not being bothered about it. I'm not exactly sure of the phraseology to use, but they chose not to intervene. Would it be fair to say that that's false?
That is false, yes. It's false because when you look at decrypted documents and other sources of information about what they were saying and did do, not just Churchill or Roosevelt, but the secret agents, the soldiers, the airmen, the spies, the civilians, the diplomats operating on behalf were saying and were doing, it is false because you can see they were doing something else. They were saying something else. There was an imperative to try and do something else. Churchill was very driven to stop the persecution of Europe's Jews. And at a daily basis, the more material you read, and particularly in European archives, obviously not just ones in London or Washington or from Israel or from Auschwitz, but in places such as Milan, Geneva, Helsinki, Zagreb, Ankara, Athens, Thessaloniki, there's a huge imperative across Europe to do something to impede and obstruct the final solution. The difficulty was that the Allies were trying to play an immensely complicated hand. They were trying to fight a war. Their aim was to, as Roosevelt and Churchill agreed, win the war as soon as and effectively as possible and thereby save Europe's Jews. That was the absolutism of the war. Bring the war to an end, capture the Nazis, kill, imprison, try those necessary, and bring the Holocaust to an end. In the meantime, do it while fighting a war on dozens of different fronts, making all of the hideous decisions that wartime entails, not blow your intelligence sources, which are rapidly becoming not just a war-winning weapon, but are becoming a wartime institution in itself. Bletchley Park's decryption and decoding system was becoming a huge tool of war-winning intelligence, and they couldn't lose that. The Jews were a priority in the eyes of Roosevelt, Churchill, and other allied and neutral leaders. They weren't the priority because they couldn't be the priority, because the war was, as Churchill, and particularly Roosevelt, kept saying, was being fought for all ends. Roosevelt didn't want to appear to the American public, who he was trying to keep united in this world war, to be fighting war on behalf of the Jews, nor did Churchill. They were fighting the war on behalf of mankind against the Nazi regime. So the limits of what they could have done when were very, very, very constrained. And the knowledge versus action differential was very great. They knew a lot. They could do relatively small amounts. They did much more than thought. And it's very, very easy, with the benefit of hindsight, 80 years later, to say they should have done this to stop this situation there, and they would have sacrificed this, is that, or the other. At the time, if they lost Ultra, they would have lost a vast chunk of their ability to wage and to win war. And it wasn't just U-boat signals in the Atlantic. It was signals and communications and intelligence and knowledge about half the planet's activities that was helping the Allied countries fight this war. And it was there behind Churchill and Roosevelt and, to a lesser extent, Stalin for the whole war. So, yes, this was predominantly absolutely false. And it brings me back to the point I was making, which was they chose to strategically suppress the source of their intelligence, but at the same time broadcast their knowledge of the Holocaust.
We've talked about during the war. The other accusation, if you like, that's levelled at the Western governments is the absence of this evidence, the SIGINT intelligence from Nuremberg. And my interpretation of that is the Cold War is starting. This is an asset that the Western governments continue to need to keep secret, but that for trial purposes, other evidence is available. Would that be fair?
I followed the chain of intelligence, the chain of information, the chain of correspondence between Bletchley Park, between the Joint Intelligence Committee, between the Allied governments, from the beginning of the war to the end, about what to do with the intelligence gained from decrypting signals about the final solution. And you can see very clearly what the British in particular want to do, which is wait until the war is over, use this information to give both to the United Nations War Crimes Commission, and also, where possible, to give to war crimes tribunals, which obviously means Nuremberg, without, very specifically at a time when the Soviet Union had been an old ally and was becoming a new enemy, without compromising the original source of the intelligence, which was Ultra. So the communication between Bletchley Park, between London, about this is, what intelligence can we submit that doesn't blow our decryption techniques at Bletchley? And the answer is that low-level intelligence about the executions on the Eastern Front, some of the German police codes are deemed to be low or medium grade cipher intelligence. They're admissible. Things that are derived from the more complex decryption of the Enigma system are deemed not admissible. So once again, the Allies are playing a careful balancing match between giving as much information as possible to the war crimes tribunals, at the same time protecting the source of the intelligence, particularly as the Cold War is starting.
So once again, you brought us back to this balance between security of SIGINT capability, which is what we're talking about, and use of intelligence. And this is the problem, not just with the Holocaust, but with almost every time we talk on this podcast about the use of intelligence product, this question arises, how do you use the product without giving away what you know? And would it be fair to summarize this story to say that that same dilemma is at the heart of this story as well?
Yes, that same dilemma is very much at the heart of this story, which is the better your capacity and capability becomes to discover intelligence, it isn't necessarily matched by a parallel ability to deploy it. And the ability to deploy intelligence without betraying its source, while at the same time making the intelligence effectively usable, is, in terms of the Holocaust, particularly in the Second World War, a terrifying contradiction and dichotomy. And as Bletchley Park's decryption systems increased and the volume increased, as the intercept operations increased, as their operations with their allies increased, and their amount of information increased, Bletchley Park became a war-winning intelligence tool. It became a center of operational excellence in itself, where intelligence gathering and intelligence decryption was being used as not just a weapon of justice and a weapon of war and a weapon of liberation. It became one where it was an object lesson in how to deploy intelligence effectively and when. And it was probably, in the history of warfare, the discovery of the information about the Holocaust and the dilemmas that it put those who had discovered it, the Allies, in terms of trying to deploy it to impede, halt, stop, obstruct the greatest war crime in the history of mankind. There cannot be any starker example of intelligence's part in modern warfare and human catastrophe.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.